This is On Story from Austin Film Festival, NPRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. 1993 saw the release of giant blockbuster films like Jurassic Park, classic comedies like Groundhog Day, rom-com staples like Sleepless in Seattle, and the inspirational true life story of an undersized, dyslexic student whose only dream was to play football for the University of Notre Dame. Rudy, written by Angelo Pizzo, has stood the test of time as a film that still resonates with an audience 25 years after its release. In 2005, the film was named one of the 25 best sports movies by ESPN and one of the most inspiring films of all time by the AFI 100 series. Pizzo, who also wrote the Indiana basketball drama Hoosiers, spoke about Rudy at the Austin Film Festival in 2015. Clips of Rudy, courtesy of TriStar Pictures, Inc.
I guess the first question maybe that comes to mind is, how did you become acquainted with this story and what attracted you to it?
Rudy, an imitable Rudy style, he basically, after he saw Hoosiers, he made a decision that we were the guys that had to tell his story. And he hunted us down like we were prey. And the first time he found out that the basketball coordinator for Hoosier's brother was the night manager of a hotel in South Bend. And he got through to him and told his story and asked if he could get in touch with his the court basketball coordinator, who also happened to be a college friend of mine, the coordinator. And he called me up. He said, "You won't believe this guy. He's like, he's kind of a pest. But he does have an interesting story." And I said, what is it? So he told me the story. And I said, "Look, I mean, I don't want to be pigeonholed as Mr. Sports Film guy. And the next movie I make, I don't want to do another sports film set in Indiana. And third, growing up in Bloomington, Indiana, I hate Notre Dame football." Mm-hmm. So I thought that was that. But here's the one characteristic about Rudy that I talked about this today earlier. He is fundamentally incapable of hearing the word no. And somehow he got my number and he called me up. And I just thought he was a hoot just talking to him, because he was just relentless. And I said, "No, I just can't do this. I'm sorry, Rudy," so on and so forth. "I've never been on that campus, and I never want to be on that campus." And he would send me stuff. He did not let go. Everything you saw in that movie was everything he did in order to get us to make the movie. Now, I still said no for a year, 2 years. David Anspaugh, who directed the movie, my closest friend, college roommate, did love the story. He actually liked Notre Dame, too. So he was telling, there was a producer and an overall deal at Columbia, and they were sharing great sports stories. And David brought up this story about Rudy. It just so happened that the producer had lunch with the president of Columbia Pictures, Frank Price. Frank Price had some Notre Dame memorabilia in his office. And when Rob, the producer, asked if he went to Notre Dame, he said it was the biggest heartbreak of his life, because he applied three times and was turned down every time. Yeah. So he thought, we have a perfect candidate for this story. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from David, said, "We got to go pitch it. You know, they set up a meeting." I said, I don't want to do it. He said, "We just come in the room. I'll pitch it myself." I said, "Okay, I'll come in the room." And this has never happened before or since in a pitch meeting, which always end in, "Thank you very much, we'll let you know." Frank Price leaned over his desk and said, "I can't wait to see this movie." And then I knew I was writing Rudy.
This may be an obvious question, but why do you think this film resonates so much with folks? I mean, it's a classic, kind of an instant classic. And what do you think it is in the movie that touches people?
When we initially came out, we are not a successful film. We only did about $23 million, and I mean, the movie cost like $13 to make and probably the same to market. And it was only in the second tier that people started watching it on video or DVD primarily, because it was a little while before it got to the airwaves. And people discovered it and started talking about it. So it had a word of mouth, but not theatrically. Mm-hmm. It's even worse now. If you don't perform out of the box, you are gone. There's too many other movies waiting in the wings to jump in there. And I gave a talk one time to a crowd of about 400 people. It wasn't Indiana, but it was in Indianapolis. And people were coming up to me and talking about Rudy on and on and on. And so I said, I asked how many people in the place had seen Rudy, and just about every hand went up. I asked how many people saw it in the theater, about 5 hands went up. Mm-hmm. So I hope that doesn't happen with our new movie, that people discover it later. But here's what I'll share in answer to your question about why it resonates and why it is sustained over the years, is because it's extremely relatable to a broad spectrum of people. Mm-hmm. Now, in order for me to write any screenplay, take on anything, I need to connect personally to it. And when I first got involved in the film business or thought about being involved in the film business, there were a lot of people telling me, you're crazy. I mean, 100,000 scripts registered with the Writers Guild every year, 200 films get made. It's like winning the lottery. It's so incredibly competitive, and only the sharks win out in the end. And I came to realize in the course of working my way through the business, because I was an executive for the first 6 years and then started doing this filmmaking thing, is that the people, the men and women who were successful in the business, were people like Rudy. They were people who did not personalize the word no, who were so resilient after hearing no, 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 no constantly, because as someone has described being in the film business, like swimming in a sea of no's, and you're desperately trying to find that one island of yes. To get really to the heart of your question, why it's relatable, is that it's not about football. It's certainly not about Notre Dame. It's about someone who takes over power of definition of self. In other words, he doesn't give it away. He doesn't let other people tell him what he can and can't do, tell other people tell him what he's capable of and not capable of. And sometimes even his father, who loves him, was telling him, I don't want you to be hurt by going into this situation. But Rudy found his own way and his own path without anybody's help. And I think I've heard a lot from a lot of people who say they get depressed and watch this movie, and they get a sense of hope. You know, because Rudy wasn't valued. Rudy didn't have any innate skills. He wasn't somebody who was even seen. He kind of blended into the woodwork. He wasn't big, fast. He wasn't athletic. He wasn't smart. He had basically a curriculum vitae of zero in high school, and yet he came up with this harebrained idea that he was going to play football at Notre Dame, and he never let it go. And I think that people have that secret dream, and I think that it's an inspiration for a lot of people, and I think it's very relatable in that way.
My father loves Notre Dame football more than anything else in the world. He doesn't believe I'm on the team because he can't see me at the sidelines during the games. Next year, my senior year, I'd love to be able to give him this gift. I would really appreciate it if you could let me dress one game next season.
Look, Rudy, the NCAA really hamstrings us with this 60 rule. In certain positions, we only have one backup. And you know every year we're competing for the national championship. Is this just for your father?
No. No, it's for everybody who told me that being a Notre Dame football player would be impossible. It's for my brothers, the kids in my high school, the guys I work with at the mill. They can't come to practice and see that I am part of the team.
Okay.
Of course, when you're telling a true story, which you've done before, and you've done multiple times, certainly you've got to discern what you can tell the way it happened and what you have to change for dramatic purposes. And I'm wondering what you may have changed in this story and why you made the choice to change, to make things more dramatic.
Well, as you know, people's lives don't lay out in three natural acts. So there is compression, there's expansion, and there's compositing with characters. And I'll give you an example of the compression. When Rudy when he graduated from high school, he didn't go to Notre Dame right away. He didn't get in the bus and go there. What he did was he joined the Navy, and he was in the Navy for 3 years. Then he came back and worked in the steel mill, and his best friend did get killed, and his best friend, and he talked about his dream. All that was true, and he went to Notre Dame and met the priest who gave him the idea of going to Holy Cross. All that was true.
So you didn't make the dress list. There are greater tragedies in the world.
I wanted to run out of that tunnel for my dad. To prove to everyone
prove
that I worked...
what?
That I was somebody.
Oh, you are so full of crap. You're 5 feet nothing. 100 and nothing. And you got hardly a speck of athletic ability. And you hung in with the best college football team in the land for 2 years. And you're also gonna walk out of here with a degree from the University of Notre Dame. In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself. And after what you've gone through, if you haven't done that by now, it ain't gonna never happen.
As far as the Charles Dutton character, the groundskeeper, that was a composite of three different people who helped him along the way. There was a groundskeeper, and there was a janitor in the Joyce Hall, which was the basketball arena, and he gave him a janitor's room to sleep in. So I just melded all those characters into one. And there was a third character I can't really remember right now. The Jon Favreau character was his best friend. That was true. There was a little bit of a kerfuffle, I guess, with Coach Devine, who was upset about this movie. He wasn't upset about it when I talked to him, because when I did research, I spent a long time talking to him, and all that was true. He did coach from a tower. He wasn't a player's coach. There were a lot of people who loved Rudy, and he wasn't one of them. And he just didn't care. It wasn't that he disliked him. And a lot of people beseeched him to dress Rudy and to play Rudy, and he did resist. Now, the scene that upset his family, I told Coach Devine I was going to do this scene, but it upset his family. And that was that when the players came in with their jerseys and laid them on the desk, which his family felt was humiliating and disrespectful. But what that was a visual correlative of something else that happened, which was there were a whole, I think there was anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15, I can't remember, seniors that went to the defensive coordinator, Joey Anto, and said they wanted to give their jersey up for Rudy. So what I tried to do is, it's a legal axiom. If I didn't get the letter of the truth, I wanted to get the spirit of the truth.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with screenwriter Angelo Pizzo. Pizzo is best known for writing the 1986 basketball drama Hoosiers and the 1993 football film Rudy. Rudy stars Sean Astin as a student who dreams of playing football at the University of Notre Dame despite significant obstacles. Clips of Rudy, courtesy of TriStar Pictures, Inc.
I'm curious, are there any moments or any scene sequences in the film that might not be obvious that were extremely satisfying to you as a writer when you saw them realized on the screen?
Well, I haven't seen this movie in 5 or 6 years, and I was I came in distant during the final game, and when you write a sequence like the Rudy, you know, you always wonder whether the chant will work. Mm-hmm. And you always wonder how all of the characters, you have to really keep on cutting in all of the characters. And I thought we did that pretty well. And that's, since that was the only part of the movie that I saw, I will say that. But the most important thing that any filmmaker can do, and I'm going to say specifically when I say we, David and I, because we did this together, but Elia Kazan said, 80% of my job is casting, 10% skill, and 10% luck. Robert Altman said, I disagree with Elia Kazan, it's 90% casting. Casting is everything. And you think you know what you have, but until you merge the character with the actor, you're looking for something a synchronicity. You're looking for a magic that you don't know necessarily is going to work. And of course, when you cast a man and a woman who fall in love with each other, you don't know if the chemistry is ever going to be there. And in the case of, we took a big chance with Dennis Hopper, who had not worked in 12 years, who were in and out of mental institutions and sanitariums. We couldn't even get insurance for him. We took kind of a risk on Sean. And when we cast Jon Favreau, he was working in Second City. He had never acted before. Vince Vaughn had really only done tiny parts. I mean, those weren't critical roles. But the Sean Astin character was really... And I look back and think about how fortunate we were. Mm-hmm. So those are the most critical decisions I think one can make.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about Sean Astin, who does seem, I think when you see this movie, you can't imagine anyone else playing that role after seeing him in the role. But of course, he wasn't probably an obvious choice. How did he become attached to this film?
Well, this was a TriStar picture, and they had the same attitude that all studios do. They want the most movie star of the movie stars. And in this case, they really, really pushed Brendan Fraser and Chris O'Donnell on us, who at that time were their favorites. And we kept on pushing back and saying, I mean, those are really handsome guys, you know, and they're big, and, you know, you're not going to... You empathize with him and connect to him. He's not every man. And somebody had mentioned, you should go see Encino Man. this kid, Sean Astin, he just feels like he's right for it. And Dave and I went and we saw it, and it was like, yeah, that's our Rudy. I let's meet with him. So we had lunch with Sean, and Sean is Rudy. He is effervescent. He's ebullient. He's just he's a little energizer bunny. He's positive, positive, positive. He was Rudy. Part of what you cast is not just an acting ability, but you cast a personality that you know has a better chance of meshing with that personality. And the other thing that I will say is, because Sean had never done the kind of acting that we could actually tell whether he could go deep and play a level of here's an important thing about Rudy. Rudy took this journey without support. So it was a lonely, lonely journey. And he was carrying a lot of pain. He was carrying a lot of disconnection, alienation, and sadness in order to make this journey. And I was questioning whether Sean could go there. And boy, he went there. He really does have, you know, he drew upon something that we didn't see, obviously. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen this movie in a long time. So I walked in here and I watched the last 15 minutes and... It's not that I forgot, but what to me is so important for this film, important for every film, and it was a key. It's a key component in Hoosiers and in this movie and in our new movie too. And that was the film score. And Jerry Goldsmith, one of the giants in the business, one of the great composers in the history of cinema. He's been nominated for 18 Academy Awards, and we were very, very lucky to get him for Hoosiers, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. And when we got the green light on this film, we called him up and said, we want you to do our next film. And he said, no matter what it is, I'll do it. He was a beautiful man, a loving man, generous in spirit and kind, and a very emotional guy. You feel Jerry's heart in the score. And he passed away about 5 years ago, and or maybe a little bit more. And one of the last interviews that he did, someone asked him to name his favorite scores out of the 170 or 80 he did in his lifetime, and among the top three was Rudy. Oh. So, and he would take this score, he called it the Rudy Suite. And he would tour Europe and play this in his concerts. It was that special to him.
I'm going to South Bend.
Well, now's not the time.
If I don't go now, I'll never be any good for you, or for me, or anybody.
I'm sorry. Well... If you have to go, then you'll have to go alone.
I know.
We continue our 25-year look back with a conversation with screenwriter Ron Niswonner. In 1993, Niswonner wrote Philadelphia, which follows an attorney who is fired from his high-powered law firm after it's revealed that he is HIV positive. The film was one of the first mainstream Hollywood films to acknowledge HIV and homosexuality. Tom Hanks won an Academy Award for Best Actor for his portrayal of lawyer Andrew Beckett. Niswonner is also known for adapting the W. Somerset Maugham novel The Painted Veil into the 2006 film of the same name. Niswonner spoke about his career and writing process at the Austin Film Festival in 2013. Clips of Philadelphia, courtesy of TriStar Pictures, Inc. Clip of Ray Donovan, courtesy of Showtime Networks, Inc. Clip of The Painted Veil, courtesy of Bob Yari Productions and Yari Film Group Releasing.
So you've mentioned that miniseries, which is based on true events, and you know your TV movie, Soldier's Girl, also based on true events. Philadelphia is sort of
based on several true events.
Yeah, and then you've written one screenplay based on a novel.
The Painted Veil.
And then also you're working on American Wife. How faithful are you to both the true events and the material in the novel?
As Betty Davis says in All About Eve, all playwrights should be dead for 200 years. What that comment is about is that there's a ruthlessness. I spoke of this, it's one of my favorite words. There's a ruthlessness that a writer must have. My loyalty is to, especially in a novel. Now, I have to say, let me talk a bit about novel. And there is a difference between true story with true living people that you owe a certain kind of allegiance to and a novel, which, you know, no offense to the book author and Michael's a fiction writer. You know, that the only, what I owe an allegiance to, which is greater than an allegiance to a novel, is to the audience for my film and to drama. I'm a dramatist, first and foremost. So I owe an allegiance to drama. And a novel is experienced completely differently than a movie. A movie is an art form in time. There's a novel called The Painted Veil that Michael's referring to by Somerset Maugham. And it's a novel that I fell in love with. It's a novella, really. It's a short novel. And it is a very interesting, I think, instructive story for screenwriting. The novel begins. It's a great opening scene. It's actually a movie scene. We're in a bedroom. We're with the heroine, who is eventually played by Naomi Watts in the movie, who is attached to American Wife, interestingly enough. So I'm becoming, and Liev Schreiber was Ray Donovan. So I'm like the Liev Naomi family go-to screenwriter, which is, I'm happy to take that role. So The Painted Veil opens in a bedroom. Our heroine, Kitty, is in bed with her lover. Of course, we're getting this through their, what we get to read in a novel that a screenwriter doesn't have use of, which we get to know what's in their heads. And they're having passionate afternoon adulterous sex, and they hear somebody try to open the door. And luckily the door was locked, and they stop, they freeze, and they watch the door handle go like this, and they watch the door handle go like that. Then they hear footsteps, and she's like, and her lover's saying, shh, like keeping her quiet. And they hear the footsteps going around to the outside patio and coming to the other door that is locked. And they watch the door handle turn. And they watch the door handle go back. And they hear the footsteps go away. And she says, it has to be Walter. You know, my maid wouldn't try to come in. She knows I was doing a nap. And her lover, played by Liev Schreiber, actually, Naomi and Liev, were lovers and played lovers in my movie, says, so what? And that begins our story.
What was that?
Perhaps it was the emotion.
Shh.
They've gone.
Oh. He heard us.
Who?
Now, that is a great opening. And I wrote the script like that. And the script existed for many, many years in development through many directors, many people coming and going to play the different roles. The great Edward Norton, I have to say he's a hero to me because he found the script about 6 years before it got made, and he became a producer of it, and he never forgot it. He never let it go. And that's a very rare thing. In Hollywood, people have very short attention spans. And so a year would go by and it didn't get made with this combination. This financing fell through. This actress changed her mind. This director, whatever. And Edward would say, okay, Ron, don't worry, I'll figure it out. And he stuck with it. So that opening never changed. We shot every script. And a lot of people had a lot of comments about various drafts. Nobody ever said, hey, we got to talk about the opening. Nobody. It was golden. It was solid. It was solid when Somerset Mom wrote it. It was solid when Ron Nicewander wrote it. We have our first preview. And the audience doesn't like Kitty. They don't like our heroine. That's a problem. It's a big problem. Someone says, an executive at Warner Brothers said something. I think he said it almost, it sort of doesn't make sense. He says, because the story is that it is Walter, it is the husband. He does know that she's cheating on him. He's a doctor in China in 1925, and he volunteers to go be a doctor in the middle of the country where there's a cholera epidemic. Cholera at 1925 is utterly fatal, and he insists that she go with him, and he basically tells her, I'm going so you will catch cholera and die. And that's why I'm insisting you go with me, because I hope you will catch cholera and die. And when she runs to her lover and says, oh, he's going to do this to me, her lover says, oh, darling, you know, cholera, it's not really that dangerous, really. Just wash your hands. Don't eat any raw vegetables. So she goes, and she actually goes with a death wish. She goes hoping to catch cholera and die, but that's not how it turns out. I won't spoil the rest of the movie. So there we are, and some executive at Warner Brothers says, well, couldn't the movie just start when they're already in China? And that would have chopped up like the first like 10 minutes. Meanwhile, your face is like, and you're going like, idiot. But guess what? He was right. How the movie starts is, we meet, the credits are in China. We meet Walter and Kitty in China. And it's actually a really good opening of this movie. I suggest seeing it. I've tested this movie. I've played this opening for people who've never seen the movie, and I've stopped it about 5 minutes in, and I've said, tell me what's happening. What's going on in this movie? And people can tell me exactly what the story is. So what happens is that we tell the story of Kitty being found with her lover, how she fell in love, why she married Walter. It's all done in flashbacks. As she's being carried in one of those salon chairs, they used to call it, you know, on the backs of Chinese guys. And she's being like this, and she's hysterical, and she's upset. And we just keep going into her mind. And it was great, because we got to meet our main character in stress and in duress when she's being victimized by her husband, as opposed to the other way around. And then we get to play with your sympathies, because you're immediately sympathetic for her. But then as you learn their story and you see how cruel she was to him, then your sympathy changes. So that was an example where Somerset Maugham was right for the novel, and we had to adapt. We had to correct him for the movie.
So it sounds like in notes you need to separate the advice from like the problem that they're trying to solve.
You know, I wrote a movie called, I wrote Philadelphia, as you know. And some of you have seen the movie Philadelphia. Yes, it was. So there is a scene in it in which Tom Hanks recites the lines of an opera aria to Denzel Washington. It is, in many people's minds, it's the best scene. And somebody, AFI or somebody who does it, listed it as one of the 100 most best scenes in American movies or something like that.
Change again, listen. Listen. I bring sorrow to those who love me.
When it went into the script, everybody hated it. And a lot of executives at the studio, a lot of people that we just asked to read the script, there were gay executives at the studio who were like really offended because what a stereotype. Like all of us gay guys listen to opera. Yeah. And Jonathan Demme and I just remember it was so shocking because I wrote it just happened like that and it went in. And I usually don't write like that. You've heard my whole long thing about all the research I do and all that one just went in. And I was actually listening to that opera aria in my house one morning. I'll tell this story. I started crying. And my lawnmower guy knocked, I lived in upstate New York at the time, knocked at my door. And I thought he had looked through the window and had seen me. And I had this intense moment of shame, which it was self-hatred. It was a gay man's self-hatred. And I was thinking, oh, look at you, you sissy, sitting here crying, listening to opera. And now Russell, the lawnmower guy, whose opinion obviously must mean so much to me, has seen you. He's seen your secret. You're gay. And I realized, That's what this movie's about. And so I just wrote it. I just wrote like, and he, Tom Hanks, puts on this opera aria and he gets all emotional. And what does that do to the straight guy? And like, that's fantastic. That just goes right in. Jonathan Demme read it and said, he looked up and he said, Ron, I don't know if we can do this to an audience. He said, I don't know. This maybe he loved, but everybody hated it. We had memos. People hate opera, blah, 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 blah. Can't we do a pop song? Can't we get Madonna to do something? That's real, folks. And I remember that Jonathan, I mean, we had a stack of memos like this. And I, you know, and I had like, and the ones from the gay executives calling me like a traitor to the tribe. And Demi looked at me and said, do you like this scene? I said, I love this scene. He said, so do I, f*** him. And now, of course, he had won 5 Oscars for Silence of the Lambs, so he has the right to say that. And it went right in. And I'll tell you who never had a moment's doubt about that scene was Tom Hanks, who said that scene. He said, of course, that's why I wanted to do the role. Now, my showrunner on Ray Donovan, we can segue to Ray Donovan, Michael. My showrunner, you know, Ann Bitterman, who created Ray Donovan, you know, Ann really, she doesn't care what you like. She doesn't care what the network likes. She didn't really care that much about what the other writers in the room liked. At least that was her approach. She didn't care if the actors liked the dialogue they were being asked to speak. She has a very sort of strong intuition about what she does. Now, that does not mean that she did not need the 4 of us, her writing staff, often wrestling with that intuition, correcting it in some cases, disagreeing vehemently with it in some cases, frequently, maybe occasionally, not frequently, winning. She, you know, she's not immovable, because you know that would be suicidal in our business. But she has a very strong sense. So in some ways, Anne writes exactly what Anne wants to see, and you guys liked it too. You know that she's lucky.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television. Ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter. Offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with screenwriter Ron Nyswaner. When we left off, Nyswaner was discussing his film, The Painted Veil, which he adapted from the novel by W. Somerset Maugham. The 2006 film stars Naomi Watts, Edward Norton, and Liv Schreiber. Nyswaner is also known for writing the 1993 film, Philadelphia, which earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay. And the Showtime series Ray Donovan, which follows an L.A. fixer, played by Liev Schreiber, who is hired to make the city's top power players' problems disappear. Clips of Philadelphia, courtesy of TriStar Pictures, Inc. Clip of Ray Donovan, courtesy of Showtime Networks, Inc. Clip of The Painted Veil, courtesy of Bob Yari Productions and Yari Film Group Releasing.
So given that, I want to talk about one episode of Ray Donovan, which is that second-to-last episode that you wrote.
The best one.
It's called Bucky Dent. And as I watched it and I tried to think sort of what was your thought process as you put this together, I was astounded by how many different plot lines there are going on at once. And there are things that have been developed throughout the entire season and then sort of new elements that get introduced. How do you balance all of that and maintaining kind of like narrative momentum?
You know, can I tell the story of how that episode, where the genesis of that is? And by the way, I really enjoy writing for television more than I do developing screenplays on my own. And it's really a golden age of television. And if that's a question anyone has, which to aim for, you know, I wish I had actually started a few years ago. They were building the sets as we were, you know, our writer's room began 3 months or so before we started shooting, which is luxurious. A network show isn't like that. That's 6 weeks. So we had an idea of the arc of the season. Anne had long ago had Bucky Dent was the title of an episode, and it was in her head. And there was one of the brothers was going to shoot a priest. That's what she had. That's some, you know, somebody. Uh-huh. And Ray would just, there would be, he would shoot and kill him. Mm-hmm. And he basically said to Ray, "I killed the priest." We were taking a tour of the boxing club. And does everybody know what a bottle episode is? So our show was going hideously over budget, but all shows do. And the bottle episode is an episode that you try to save money by having everything take place on one set. Like, that's the episode where they get trapped in the elevator. You know, in Mad Men, there was an episode where Don Draper, like, works all night in the office, and it's just him and Peggy, and they get to know each other. So, you know, it's like, so you didn't have to leave the set, you know. So, right. So we were taking a tour of the Fight Club, the boxing gym, which is a big part of the series. And my colleague and I, Sean, we got this idea that said, what if they don't kill the priest? What if they actually kidnap the priest? And we have our bottle episode. They have the priest kidnapped here. And they spend the episode deciding what to do with him. Should we kill him or let him go? And that was actually one of the ideas when we got back to the office and pitched that to Anne. She just loved that idea. So that idea went up right, you know, early on. So our version of a bottle episode was that we went to our standing sets. Mm-hmm. So we didn't just stick with that story because, as Michael was pointing out, we had established several stories that we had to touch base. You know, we had to touch base with the other things going on in Ray's life. Ray's an LA fixer. We had to touch base with his wife. So how we, in an outline and in a script, decided when to go to those places, you know, you had to find, in that day in which these guys are trapped in a gym trying to decide the fate of this priest, it's also in which the biggest secret from their past is revealed. You have to find those places where you can take an emotional break from that play. That's really written like a play, so that there's some moment of stasis. So I created these moments where, like, well, okay, we can't agree with what to do with the priest, but you know what? Let's send my gal Friday, Lena, out there in the world to find out if anybody saw us my stupid, retarded brother kidnapped the priest. Because if there were witnesses, then we have to call, you know, he's going to be in trouble and we have to call the police. You know, but if there are no witnesses, then that's a different story. So we kept just trying to find these places where there was a break in the story, in the tension, where you'd be holding the tension. And then the gal Friday came back at one point. But then we broke away. We checked in with the other characters. And then Lena came back and said, there are no witnesses to anything that happened that I can find. And then Ray says, oh, great, no witnesses? So nobody can tie my brother to this priest. So if this priest disappears, my brother won't get in trouble. You know, and then that sets up the next section.
Oh, mother of God, this has been some terrible mistake.
You think I don't recognize you, O'Connor?
St. Josephine, South Boston.
No, I never served in Boston. I'm from Philly.
You're from Philly, huh?
I don't know you.
I don't know your brother.
You don't know my brother?
No, I don't.
How do you know he's my brother?
When he brought me here, he said I have to call my brother.
Terry! Get in here. Hold out your hands. Do it. Hold up your hands. Which one did you break when the tried to rape you?
The right one. I have arthritis. I need medical attention. I don't want to get anyone into trouble, but you have to help me.
I don't have to do anything.
Sort of a larger question about the show and the characters in it. Like other shows that are on TV right now, so Breaking Bad, even shows like The Sopranos, there are characters who are the main character, but they are not often likable, or they're also the villains. Mm. And I wonder, how do you balance having a character do things that's going to turn the audience off or make us dislike them, at least temporarily, because they're awful things, and yet not turn the audience off altogether? Because as you mentioned with A Painted Veil, if the audience begins to, for a long time, not like a character, then you're screwed.
Well, you know, first of all, you have to know who your audience is. You know, and so in a Showtime or HBO cable show, you know, Tony Soprano is the model of the unlikable hero. I mean, and so cable audiences embrace that. Now, there's unlikable. I don't even know what that word means, unlikable, actually. Because I find both Tony Soprano, I like Tony. I mean, you know, you kind of like want to hang out with him, like just right. Not when he's killing somebody or torturing right. somebody, but you know, like, Tony, I'll wait. You know, we'll have coffee after. Like, yeah, call me. I kill the guy, and I'll be here. But the unlikability thing is the villain, not the villain, is the protagonist the unlikable, the anti-hero? Is there a compelling reason for us to be engaged with that person? That likability, you know, a character's not sympathetic. You know, a character's not likable. To me, am I engaged with that character? You know, I keep referring to this movie because it had such an impact on me. You know, and Blue Jasmine, I mean, is she likable? You know, the Cate Blanchett, is she likable? I mean, like, she's obnoxious, pathological liar and a phony, you know, and yet I was so engaged with her. You know, it broke my heart at the end. So it's about whether I'm engaged with that character. Is there something about that person that I can see myself in? You know, Ray is shut off from the world, but yet he strives to be a good husband and a father. So I certainly know what that's like. I know what that's like to feel that I don't really belong in this world. I've had periods of my life where I felt that way profoundly, and yet I strive to belong. And so that, you know, am I an insider? Am I an outsider? That's a universal question. It's a universal struggle that I think all human beings, you know, we always think that the pretty cheerleader in high school, like, they were the worst. They're the ones, you know, who always felt like, everyone hated me. I'm ugly. You know, so it's always that, it's always the difference between the outside and the inside, the interior and the exterior, that I think that makes characters really compelling. And that's why cable television is so much more compelling than network television, because that's what the networks, it's not about, can you say on ABC? Who cares? It's that in network TV, people are exactly what they present. There's no subtext. They don't have secrets. They don't have secret lives that they're protecting. It's like, we can't, that's too complicated for network executives to handle. But that is really that's the most interesting place to write. And those of you who did my class, you know, write the characters. Don't tell me what the truth of your character is. Tell me what confuses your character. Why is your character lost in life? Even if he or she doesn't know they're lost, especially Ray Donovan goes through life fixing everybody's problems because he knows what he's doing. He is so lost. And that's what makes him, I think that's what made the show a success. His soul is so disturbed and broken, and all he does is go through life fixing other people.
You mentioned earlier how you're working on the AIDS epidemic sort of story, and you're plotting out the timelines and sort of chronology of all those people's lives. Mm. And it makes me think of a scene in Philadelphia in which Tom Hanks's character is fired from his job, but we don't see the firing scene in terms of how it chronologically happens. We don't see it until he walks into Denzel Washington's character's office and is saying, please, can you represent me? And then we sort of flash back and see that. How did you know to do that? How did you know? Because I mean, the scene itself, even if it's not sort of framed by another scene, is a really powerful scene. Why did you choose to frame it within this other one?
You know, I have a simple answer to that, actually, because every movie is a love story. Every movie, I think every great compelling movie has a central relationship to it. And the central relationship in that movie is between Tom Hanks' character Andrew and Denzel Washington's character Joe. By the way, in the first draft of the script, Denzel's character was Joe Napolitano. That's a cast. Denzel came to us and said, I want to play Joe. We're like, you want to play Joe Napolitano? He said, no, you have to change the name. He said, but don't change one word. And I have to tell you, we were both those actors came to us. We were the hot movie in development in 1992. And that's an extraordinary experience. It was like every A-list actor took Jonathan Demme out to lunch. We were the hot movie. But Denzel, we actually had to think, at first we thought, we're doing this movie about discrimination against gay people with AIDS, and then we have a black lawyer, and for a moment we thought, it's too complicated. It's like, it's too much potential discrimination and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, thank you. You know, we had that conversation. We said, no, just relax. He's a great actor. And it was Denzel who said, don't change a word. I'm just going to play the part. Just change my last name. But the structure of the firing scene. So their relationship was central. So what I couldn't do, I had to know when I was going to go back and forth. And I could only stay away from one of those characters. And that, you know, that's funny. That movie has dual main characters in a way. I think we think of Tom as the main character because he won the Oscar and he's Tom Hanks and, you know, and he plays the one who dies and all that stuff. But really, you think, if you look at screen time, there are two main characters. It's an odd structure, actually. And we do go away. You know, we spend some time with Tom, and then we go away for a while. And we spend some time with Denzel, and we keep doing that back and forth, back and forth. But the central relationship is there. It's their love story. Mm-hmm. So it, in the firing story, it, the emotional impact is about him relaying that to Denzel. He's asking him to represent him. So that's the dramatic tension of the scene. I'm looking for a lawyer. Will you? And eight other lawyers that I've talked to have said no, and I'm going to tell you what happened to me. Will you represent me? That's the emotional through line of the scene.
Didn't you have an obligation to tell your employer you had this dreaded, deadly, infectious disease?
That's not the point. From the day they hired me, the day I was fired, I served my clients consistently, thoroughly, with absolute excellence. If they hadn't fired me, that's what I'd be doing today.
And they don't want to fire you for having AIDS, so in spite of your brilliance, they'd make you look incompetent, thus the mysterious lost file? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Correct. I was sabotaged.
I don't buy it, counselor.
That's very disappointing.
I don't see a case.
I have a case. If you don't want it for personal reasons.
Thank you, that's correct, I don't.
Well, thank you for your time, Counselor.
You know, Philadelphia is especially, it was made a certain time. I remember very clearly when Jonathan Demme and I finally got a story that was based on a courtroom drama, and we took it to Mark Platt. And Mark Platt said, he was the head of TriStar Pictures at the time. He said to me, I'll never forget it. It was such a moving moment in my life. He said, you know, Ron and Jonathan, there are 10 scripts out there in the development, the Hollywood world. This is 1990, early in the AIDS epidemic. I mean, well, actually sort of in the middle, if you think from 81 really is when the beginning. So he said there are 10 other scripts out there right now. People are shopping around. It's about AIDS. They all have heterosexual main characters. And this is one of those executives who said to us, those bad executives, he said, that's immoral. He said, we're going to make this movie because this is the movie that has to be made. You know, so we had an open door. Now, Jonathan Demme made Silence of the Lambs, which was released in 1991. But they did put Philadelphia into development in 1990. And then, so it was 1991. And it was really about the subject. That at that time, there were a group of courageous people at TriStar and at Sony who really believed in the movie. And, you know, their jobs are on the line more than ours. I'd always sell another screenplay. So they really did take a risk. And then with Silence of the Lambs, it's just John, you know, I mean, both actors won Oscars. I mean, you know, the third time in history that won the 5 top Oscars. And so every actor wanted to be in anything that Jonathan was doing. But I really think that they came because it was just a time when it was so different then. You know, people just knew. The head of Sony, I don't know if he's the head of Sony, Mike Medavoy, he was like the chairman. He was the person that you never saw. And one day they said, Mike wants to give you notes on the script. I'm like, Mike is giving you notes? Like that never, like Mike Medavoy? So I went up in an elevator alone. They said, just Ron. Like Jonathan's like, what? And I went up in an elevator to Mike's like penthouse office. And Mike told me the story about the sculptor whose work he's been collecting that he loved, who's dead. And he said, and the guy was like, excuse me. It's an emotional time. The guy was like 32. And he said, something horrible is happening in our country. Your movie has to tell America that. Now get out of here. That was his note. those days, I mean, that, so they were extraordinary and heroic people. So I'm giving the executives their props.
The Federal Vocational Rehabilitation Act of 1973 prohibits discrimination against otherwise qualified handicapped persons who are able to perform the duties required by their employment. Although the ruling did not address the specific issue of HIV and AIDS discrimination,
subsequent decisions have held that AIDS is protected as a handicap under law, not only because of the physical limitations it imposes, but because the prejudice surrounding AIDS exacts a social death which precedes the actual physical one.
This is the essence of discrimination. Formulating opinions about others not based on their individual merits, but rather on their membership in a group with assumed characteristics.
You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mites. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.